Hi, this is Sammy Walker, and you're listening to Level Playing Field.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Level Playing Field Podcast, part of the Outsports Podcast Network. My name is Randy Boos, and I am your host for this podcast. Each week, I speak to an LGBTQ athlete or sports personality. This week, I speak to trans athlete Sammy Walker from England. We talk a lot in this hour episode. Some of the stuff is about self-harm, so if that's something that might cause issues with you, I recommend skipping past that part. We also talk about something that a lot of people in the trans community have to deal with, and that is self-medication. Sometimes our medical systems in the US and in the UK maybe, or some other place, might not be moving at the speed you need it to go. So we talk about Sammy's experience, how she's dealt with the transition, what she does to do it, and how she started. It's not recommended for everybody. It's something that she felt she had to do, though, to be honest with you, to save her own life. Just something to keep an eye out. She also makes the same comment. Anyways, I don't want to keep talking. Let's go ahead and start this episode. Without further ado, here is Sammy Walker. Welcome, Sammy, to my podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
You reached out to me this past week, and I was excited to tell your story. Let's begin at the beginning. How did you get involved in sports?
I've always been into sports. I've been playing football or soccer, as you guys would know it as, since I was 4 years old. My parents, my family were all massive sports fans, and it was kind of bound to happen, really. So when I was four, I was playing for like an under-eights side, which is like the youngest that you can play. So I was playing like 4 years up, like with kids double my age when I was really young.
Oh, okay. What's your earliest football memory you have?
I think probably the first football match I ever went to. I think I was about 4 or 5 years old, and I went to go and see West Ham United play against Man United. And I'd just never seen that many people in the same place before, and it just really captivated me. It was just amazing. All the crowd chanting, and it just made me think, I really want to do that. I really want to go and be on that pitch.
What's your first playing memory then?
First playing memory, I remember being taken to a team called Woburn Lions, which were a kids' team in sort of like the Buckinghamshire, Bedfordshire border in about an hour north of London. And I was tiny, you know, I was only 4 or 5 years old, and all the other kids were like 8 or 9. And it was really, really daunting. But I remember playing and then getting picked the next week to start the match. And it was like a real kind of, oh, I'm actually kind of, I can do this. You know, it was a real confidence booster for me. And yeah, like I say, between that and the first experience of watching live professional football, that was it for me. I've always been keen on it. And it's been a passion of mine ever since.
So where did you grow up?
I moved around quite a lot. But I grew up mainly about an hour north of central London, just outside the big M25 ring road that goes out. So it's kind of more country, kind of small town kind of thing. But then I moved to a place called Milton Keynes, which is quite like a larger city. And then I moved down to London as an adult.
Oh, okay. So did you grow up near, I think I've been up there, up by Aylesbury. Is that close to where
Aylesbury,
you grew up?
Yeah, that is where I was born.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I've actually stayed in a travel lodge in Aylesbury. Not
very
recommended,
classy,
by the way.
Yeah.
Never again.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't advise it. I mean, it's nice for driving through. Aylesbury's very nice for driving through. It's quite nice to look at, but not nice to be in.
I've still got
like a few supportive family members up there that I go and see occasionally.
What was your childhood like? You mentioned moving around a lot.
Yeah, I mean, my parents divorced when I was quite young. As a result, I was kind of split between two households. Then both my parents remarried, had kids, and I ended up, when I was very young, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents. And then we just moved the house a lot. You know, I think I lived in like 21 houses by the time I was 18. It was pretty crazy.
Oh, damn. That is crazy.
Yeah.
When did you start to notice things were different for you in regards to your gender?
I guess young, really young. I was probably 4 or 5 years old. Probably when I started school, I think, was probably when I realized, I was like, oh, okay, I'm not like the other boys here. You know, I was way more comfortable with the girls. But I still had like some, I guess, classically masculine traits. I was really into sports. So, you know, and as a result of that, it caused a lot of confusion for me. But yeah, it wasn't until I was a lot older that I kind of even was aware that, I guess, that who I was really.
Yeah, it's funny because if you grew up now, I think kids have a better sense of, you know, sports aren't for the boys. Sports can be played by anybody.
Totally. I mean, when I was going to school, it was the early mid 90s. And, you know, the girls played hopscotch and the boys played football. That was still kind of the status quo back then. And I guess I grew up in kind of a changing world. But back then it was still very much, you know, regimented into gender stereotypes, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What about football made you feel the most comfortable? Like, what did you like about football the most when playing?
You know, I think football's always been a bit of an escape for me. When I'm playing, I'm only thinking about the game. And I think I used it as an escape a lot when I was growing up. I was always playing football. I'd go to school, lunchtime would come round, I'd be playing football. Finish school, I'd go to the park, I'd play football till it got dark. I'd go home, I'd play football in the hallway and break stuff, kicking the football around. And I guess it did become very much an escape. I had to concentrate in order to do keepy ups, to concentrate on my positioning on where I had to be on the pitch. And it became all encompassing for me. And it was very much sort of an escape tactic for me, and an effective one.
So then the moment you step off the pitch, how do you feel? I mean,
now I feel good.
Back then. But no, back when you step off the pitch.
Yeah.
Your match is done.
Yeah, that match is done. You get a little bit of a buzz after the match. But when you get home and you have your bath and you're like, oh, no, I'm back to where I was again, you know. And so as a result, I was playing football 5-6 times a week.
You know, you talked about, you know, how you felt at 4 or 5 and how sports were confusing for you. In an era where sexuality became a thing, you obviously didn't feel right with your gender, but did sexuality confuse did it confuse you at all on
totally.
Who you were?
So I recognized, you know, I say quite young that I was quite feminine, and that I had to try to be a boy. You know, I had to really, really try to try and display a lot of those kind of boy kind of thing, you know, traits. And I think that the only being gay was kind of a known thing, you know, it wasn't an okay thing still back then. You know, kids got teased if, you know, being gay was, you know, oh, you're gay, it's a slur, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I attributed a lot of who I was to, you know, I was like, oh, maybe I'm gay. And I knew that even at that young age, even though I didn't really understand it, I knew that it was wrong, even though it isn't wrong, you know. And so I guess that kind of confused me a lot. And it wasn't until somebody that I knew, when we were probably 15, started dressing like a girl and started to transition in their teenage years. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe that's it. And that was when it kind of first started sort of mulling over in my head that, oh, okay, maybe it's a me thing. Maybe it's not an outward thing. Maybe it's an internal thing.
And was this someone from school or?
No, it was like a friend of a friend.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that must have been mind-blowing that there was an option for you.
Yeah, and I think because I never really felt gay. I think that was the reality of it, is I didn't feel like a gay man at any point in my life. I had experimented in my teenage years, and it always felt as kind of off and weird as when I was with girls. So it never really felt right. And I say when I realized that, you know, being transgender could be a thing, and that you could transition, that you could be like who you felt like you should be. You know, that was really mind-blowing for me. But growing up, you know, the people that I had, that I knew that were born male, that presented female, were like, you know, drag queens on TV or like Eddie Izzard. And I was like, I'm not Eddie Izzard, you know?
But he does happen to like the best football team in the world.
Which is that?
Crystal Palace.
Oh, yeah, that's a shame. That's not right.
Wow.
It's clearly got to be West Ham. West Ham are by far the best team.
Oh, jeez. I don't think so. Who's sixth place right now in the table? That would be the Eagles.
Okay. We'll see how far you fall.
Oh, stop. Getting back to the talk. And, you know, I tweeted out today that one of the things that you learn, and it should be something that's second nature to you, but every person has their own ideas, their thoughts. The trans athlete debate conversation isn't one where everyone's the same. So some of the stuff that we say today might not match what you think or whatever for the people listening, but it's just part of the discussion. What I want to ask you is having the T in LGBT be part of that acronym, did that almost hurt you in a way? Did that cause more confusion?
I don't think it caused more confusion. I think it causes more confusion for other people. Lesbian, gay, bisexual are all sexualities, and being transgender isn't a sexuality. And I think it causes a lot of confusion. It causes a lot of misappropriation. And misunderstanding, especially amongst cis heteronormative people, because they see it as like a sexually motivated thing as a result. And I think that's it can sometimes be a little bit damaging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that.
But equally, it's a community that has welcomed me with open arms. And if it wasn't, for a lot of my LGBT friends, that, I wouldn't have got through some of the really dark periods of my time. So, it's not a wholly negative thing. I really like to stress that point. It's not a negative thing at all, and it's great to be part of something where who you are matters more than what you are.
Yeah, and like you said, it's internally the group is great, but it's the people outside of the group that really cause the confusion. Yeah,
correct.
Going back to when you were 15 and you had this, friend of a friend start to transition themselves. And you had this awakening, like there was another option for you. Mentally, you had to be going through almost like a stress relief with that. Did that cause more problems?
I mean, it was relieving to know that there was another option that made more sense to me. But at that time, I was always, I was on the books playing football for a Premier League side. I was touted to play for, to go professional. And it was that, for somebody who had, personally, I had really thrown myself into like, okay, well, I just have to try and be a guy because that's what I'm supposed to be, And it was a long way to, even at that point, it was like, oh, Christ, this is a long way to fall,
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it wasn't until later in life that I was like, okay, that I had the courage and the conviction to be able to go and say, this is who I am, and to hell with what you think.
Yeah. And it would be years before you actually start to transition, right?
Yeah, I didn't start my transition until I was 26 and a half, pushing 27.
Yeah. And so how long did you play football?
I mean, I played football 25 years now.
I mean, on that level where you were progressing in the men's game and you had dreams and hopes of being
probably
going
up
higher.
Until probably 17, 18 that I was playing at like the highest level that I could. And probably I think that I was a little bit of a late developer puberty wise. And I think that had a real impact on me. When my body started changing. I think seeing my body change and it going from being, when we're young and we're kids, kids just have kids' bodies,
Mm-hmm.
And I think once you hit puberty, you start going, oh Christ, this isn't right. This is horrible, And I think dysphoria really started to set in around 17, 18. And I felt super uncomfortable in my body. And I just went downhill really, really quickly. And my mental health, as a result, I struggled with for the next 10 years.
When you say dysphoria, what do you mean?
I guess it's that kind of feeling that you're not what you're supposed to be, or worrying that you'll never be who you feel you should be, or looking in the mirror and wanting to claw your face off, I just hated it. I could see the way that testosterone was changing my bone structure, changing the way that I looked, changing the body hair, and it made me feel sick. And it really, really affected me.
Mm-hmm. As as a teen boy myself at one time, I think that when you are about to enter puberty, you're sort of envious of the other boys in the locker room who have already started. But I imagine for you, your delayed start of puberty, did that did that help you? Did it make you feel better about yourself?
I think so. I think I felt better that it almost was like proof that I wasn't like them. I guess a little bit in a weird way at the time. I was like, okay, well, I'm not doing what they're doing, so maybe there is something different with me. And obviously when it started to start happening, I was like, oh no. I think it did have a big effect. And I think that being able to still see a level of femininity in myself when I was in my younger teens made it a lot easier for me to not hate what I look like. But that got progressively worse as I got older.
You know, the brain is so powerful, and I'm not even going to pretend to understand, you know, what it does and what it can do. But I almost wonder if your body was trying to tell you too, with the late start, that you were right in your feelings and your thoughts, you know?
I mean, I don't know if there's any medical evidence to back that up, but it's a thought. I mean, it's a nice thought, but I mean, I guess looking back at it from now, you know, I wish that I had more exposure and knew that it was okay to be different. And I think you see a lot of this stuff, especially when you see like the people teaching LGBT stuff to kids. Mm-hmm. And they're all up in arms. And the reality is that people are up in arms because they don't want their kids to be gay, or they don't want their kids to be trans. They want their kids to be normal. And it troubles me that there's the push for normality over happiness. But being, when I was young, I think that I would have benefited from knowing that it was okay to be whoever I felt I was.
Yeah. I think for some parents too, it's the dream that they had for their child.
Exactly. You know, it's the idealized image, isn't it?
Yeah. It's the dream that they have that's falling apart. That's not going the way they want. And that's where the confusion or the anger or the denial comes from.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I can never understand what it's like to be trans, what it's like to be trapped in a body that's not who you are. Can you try to explain what that was for you as a teen, late in your teen years? I imagine the mental health issues must have been tremendous.
Yeah, I mean, I spent my entire adult life from 18 to when I sort of finally came out and transitioned, that I spent that entire time medicated for anxiety, for depression. I was very, very angry at the world because I didn't know who to blame for why I felt like this. And I think it's been weird because I think transition's almost been like a cure-all for me. And I've been able to realize that a lot of the things that I felt were normal, even though I didn't understand them at the time.
When you would reach low points, because I'm sure, you know, you sort of have ups and downs with your moments. When you reach your low moments in life, what would you do to try to turn that around?
I mean, I had a real issue with self-harm throughout my teens and early 20s. I felt like I needed to be punished because I was different and I was wrong. And I was made to feel that way. There were certain members of my family that were very openly anti-LGBT, and I felt like who I was, you know, some sort of abomination. I felt like I needed to be punished, and I think that I used physical pain to manage that a lot of the time, you know. But if anybody else who's listening to this does that similarly, like, please, like, don't do that to yourself. I totally get why you do it, and I get what drives you to it, but you know, it's a temporary solution to a permanent problem. And a lot of the time, just being honest to yourself is what you need.
Yeah. I guess it would just be a relief for the moment and then quickly come back. So
yeah, I think it's you're just replacing emotions rather than working through them, you know?
If you had that to do over again, what do you think would have been healthier? I mean, I ask that just for the people that listening that might be having those issues, might be doing self-harm.
I mean, honestly, I would rather have just been open and honest. I think it's very hard to accept who you are when you don't know who you are. But if you're in that place where you don't know what else to do other than to cause yourself physical harm, then, you know, reach out to people. Reach out to people that you trust. You know, reach out to your friends. You know, it's okay not to be okay. There's a big campaign it's a big campaign in England at the moment called Ask Your Mate Twice. So don't just ask your friend how you are once. Ask your friend And, you know, because you say, oh, how are you? And they go, oh, I'm fine. But, you know, they're probably not fine. You know, so ask them again, are you sure you haven't been yourself? And they go, oh, well, actually. And then there's the problem. You know, if you just ask them once, people are going to fob you off. And there's a responsibility on both sides of that. There's a responsibility for the person who's suffering to be open and trust people. And there's a responsibility on the people that are providing the support to, you know, provide a concerted effort. Because when you're going through a tough time, you know, sometimes you need a little push.
Mm-hmm. How would soccer or football, would you play football all throughout your early 20s? Or is there a time where you stopped temporarily?
Yeah, I stopped. So there were some life things that happened in my early 20s that really threw me off and threw me, I put it into the wilderness. And I didn't play football again, other than the odd kick around with friends or guest playing for somebody if the team was short. But I didn't actually sign on for a team for 8 years. And it wasn't until I moved back down to London, sort of a year into my transition, that I found inclusive football, which is anybody within LGBT can play. It's mixed gender. It's arguably the most diverse form of sport that I've ever played. And it was a real lifesaver. It gave me the ability to reclaim my mental health, to exercise, and to feel normal. You know, it's a lot to be said for just going to do normal stuff, you know, and be included as part of a team and be accepted.
So you talk about that gap, though. What was the point where you actually made the decision to transition, where you finally realized that this is what I need to do to get better, to feel who you are? Do you remember that moment?
Yeah, I mean, I had been, you know, self-employed. I had a reasonably successful business, and I did my thing, and everything that, you know, a guy could want, and I was still miserable. I was as miserable as I was when I was 18. I was still depressed. I was still looking in the mirror and thinking, "Oh God, I can't. This isn't me. This isn't me. I'm not who I should be." You know. And it was very, very difficult. And it got to the point where I had a bit of a breakdown. And yeah, it was tough. But, you know, ultimately, about 3 months after that all happened, I was like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And I went for it. And I've never looked back. And it was honestly the best decision I've ever made. It was being able to commit to being myself and to have the courage to do it, despite knowing that it was going to cause problems, or, you know, I knew that it was the right thing for me.
And so who's the first person you tell that you're going to do this?
Probably my friend, McCall. She lives in New York, actually. We had become friends via Instagram. And yeah, I told her, and she was super supportive. And she even flew me out to the States so I could have a chance to be myself away from the life I had. And that was a real turning point for me, and I'll be forever grateful to her for that.
Do you think it was easier to tell someone like that instead of...
Yeah, I guess I was sort of testing the waters a little bit. And then when I came back from the States, I told a few of my friends, and I got sort of a mixed response. But I think it's very difficult for people when, you know, if you've known someone for 20 years and then suddenly they say, oh, by the way, I'm not that person. You know, I think sometimes it could be hard for, you know, somebody who comes out as friends to sort of accept that that's who they are, because if they accept that's who they are, then they also accept that you've been lying to them for X amount of years. And that makes it, yeah. I think there's a bit of an incongruence in that, you know, and I think that makes it quite difficult.
Yeah, I could see that. I guess it's just hard though, because it is something that you had to deal with for so long that once you're able to finally reveal who you are, there, as a friend, you'd hope that there would be an acceptance.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I've had, you know, 10, 15 people that have really championed me and really supported me. And without them, I couldn't have done all this. But yeah, I think that it was very difficult for the majority of people that I knew that had an image of me that in their heads that was shattered.
So how does the transition process start for you? Are you doing private or NHS?
So the obviously in the UK we have the national health system, which, you know, as a principle is a fantastic idea, but in practice doesn't really provide adequate care for anybody in any circumstance. So for me, I went to my general practitioner, my local doctor, and said, you know, this is what I want to do. And he sort of just looked at me and went, no, you know, wouldn't refer me. So I called back again and I asked to speak to a female doctor. And the lady I spoke to was a lot more sympathetic, and she referred me to the clinic. This was about 6 months after I came out. So that was, I mean, this is, we're talking quite recently, you know, this is within the last 2 years, 18 months. And I'm still yet to have my first appointment with the gender identity clinic.
Oh, and this is so in London, right?
And this is in London, yeah. So there's like one or two clinics that serve the whole of the UK. And they're so underfunded, they're understaffed, there's not enough of the people that know what they're talking about or are experts in it. And so it can actually be really, really difficult to transition in the UK. But honestly, I think if I'd relied solely on the healthcare provision that was provided by the state, I don't think I'd be here today.
Oh, wow. So I didn't know that. I mean, because we've been talking this past week via Twitter. So you, when you start to transition, you actually started...
So yeah, I did a lot of research. I spoke to a lot of girls that I knew that had transitioned and had done so successfully. And, you know, and I've been responsible with it. I've made sure I've had my blood tests done. I've taken care of myself. And arguably, I think I've given myself a better care and a better transition than I would have had if I'd relied on what was provided.
How do you do this on your own? I mean, I don't want specifics about, you know, where you get the stuff from and all that stuff, but I'm just saying, how do you research and how do you know what to do?
I researched stuff. I looked into normal ranges of testosterone in females, XY females, as well as XX females. I did comparisons. If I didn't understand something, I Googled that. Google's been my best friend in this transition. You know, luckily there's a lot of resources and a lot of information online. And if you're willing to put the time in and read scientific papers, and if you don't understand stuff, read other stuff so that you understand that stuff, you know, you can do it. But like I said, I've had a lot of people around me that are way further into their transition, that have finished their transition. And my flatmate at the moment is a little bit older than me, but has completed their transition, had all of her surgeries, et cetera, et cetera. So I've had a lot of people guiding me. It hasn't totally been a solo effort, so to speak. My transition is going really well. I am healthy. I'm doing well. And I think another really key thing to point out is that for so many trans people, what you look like affects the way people perceive you. And, you know, your doctor doesn't really care what you end up looking like. They care about treating a condition. And it's not that it's what you look like matters, you know, it shouldn't matter, but it does affect how people perceive you and how people treat you. And I think for a lot of trans people, that reliance on somebody else can come sometimes be a bit of a detriment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't encourage it as an option. You know, this isn't safe to do it without medical attention. It's not safe, but it's necessary for me. Because I can't, you know, 18 months ago, when I first went to my doctors, if I hadn't have taken responsibility for my own care, then nobody else was.
Yeah, I just can't imagine what you've been through, what you've had to deal with the last, you know, 27 or so years before you start transition. You go to the doctor to finally get this taken care of and start the transition process. And then they just go, whoa, now let's stop here. And
yeah, it was very much a kind of, are you sure? You know, like anybody takes this decision lightly, you know?
And then you have to deal with this with the doctor who, like I said before, I can't imagine what it was like to grow up trans, to be in a body that didn't match who you were. And then to have people on the internet, or more importantly, your doctors, just go, you know what, you need to slow down. You don't really know what you're talking about. So we're going to make this process go from, you know, months to years, because that's just what it should be.
Totally, totally. And I think there needs to be some responsibility on the doctor's side, because my flatmate, for example, she transitioned way before, you know, she's a little bit older than me. She transitioned way before me. When she first went to the gender identity clinic, they were saying to her, you know, they gave her a chance to sit down and speak through everything. And she had 4 or 5 appointments before anything really got moving. And it was a matter of weeks between those appointments. Whereas now it's a matter of 18 months, 2 years between appointments. And as a result, they're so overwhelmed that in practice, the responsibility isn't falling at anybody's feet. It's just a kind of, you know, chuck everyone on hormones and see what happens. And
let's talk about, so since you started transitioning, you obviously feel, there's a point where you just feel, is there a point where you feel complete, where you feel you completely?
I mean, I'm not there yet by any means. You know, I'm still not 100% happy with the body that I'm in, but I'm hopeful. And I think that's there's a lot to be said for having hope, you know. You know, I feel like there is an option for me to be myself, you know, be mm-hmm. who I thought I should always be. And there is hope of me getting there at some stage. But ultimately, I'm able to exist now without feeling that I'm faking who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really big deal.
Yeah, because you are Sammy and you are a football player.
Yeah.
What was it like finding was it Soho FC you played for first?
Well, originally when I first transitioned, I went and played for a ladies team.
Did you?
Funnily enough, yes. I spent 3 months living in Aylesbury at my aunt's house when I first transitioned. And I think a bit longer than 3 months, actually. Anyway, I spent time in Aylesbury. And I played for a ladies team near there. And it was fine at first. Everyone was kind of a little bit weirded out, I think. I was still very early in my transition and didn't look like I do now. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the people there didn't necessarily agree that I should be there. I think I was probably playing with them for, I don't know, a month and a half, 2 months of training. And one night the coach came up to me and was like, look, can you just like, you know, dial it back a bit? I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, you know, you're kind of too good to, you know, everyone else feels it's kind of feeling like you're making everyone else feel like they can't play football. And I was like, I don't understand what you mean. I'm playing football the way I always play football. And I never went back after that because I felt like I was like, oh, okay, well, it's not the place for me then, because I think they'd had other people going, oh, you know, why is he here? You know?
So you think it was more about gender than talent?
Oh, 100%. 100%. 100%. It was because it was who I was. Mm-hmm. The reality is that I played football at quite a high level. I've always been quite, you know, one of the better players on any team that I've played on. And I think that it's been, and even now that I play in a team predominantly, I mean, I'm the only girl on that plays for Bristol Panthers, which is the team that I play for now. And at training the other day, I was the only female there, and I still hold my own.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And for me, I prefer the challenge of playing against guys. I think that any girl that grew up playing football dreamed of playing, you know, until the women's football became a thing, they dreamed of playing in the Premier League, and they couldn't because they were girls. And so I feel quite lucky that I'm able to play with the guys and hold my own and you know, be able to play at a level that I feel is, you know, faster paced and challenges me more.
It's actually an interesting thing to think about because, you know, you talk about boys dream of being in the Premier League, girls dream about the Premier League too, but they didn't have an option. But then you always knew you were a girl, but you still have those dreams that the boys had of playing the best, playing the boys.
Totally, 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 totally. And I think that I did have because when I was, you know, say in my sort of mid-teens, late teens, when I was playing at the highest level that I could possibly play at, You know, I thought, you know, maybe it was sort of a stuck between which one do you do, because one I knew, you know, one option of being myself and being true to myself would offer me happiness, and the other one would offer me a really, really privileged life. You know, and that's a really difficult decision to make when you're like, you know, a teenager, because you don't really understand life, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And typically I went with the one that most teenagers, I think, would make at that decision at that time, which is, I want a nicer life, because at least, because if I have a nicer life, I can choose to transition later on. And it ultimately was the wrong decision. I should have been honest and true to myself and transitioned when I was younger. But, you know, honestly, I don't think I had the mental fortitude at that time to be able to do it.
Yeah, I wonder if, yeah, I couldn't imagine doing that, especially with the health system the way it was for you, if it would have been any better back then.
I mean, arguably, even though, it probably would have been. It probably would have been.
Really?
I think that, yeah, because I think that the usage of transgender services and the gender clinics in the UK has shot up massively. And like I said, I think this is largely because of, there's a multitude of factors, but I think it's largely because it's more accepted and it's more known. You know, it's no different to, you know, more people feel comfortable coming out, for example, as gay or lesbian, since it's become more socially acceptable. And I think that's really the crux of the matter for a lot of these issues is social acceptability. Had I known that I could have, you know, that it was a genuine possibility when I was 12 or 13, I think I probably would have liked to avoid going through a male puberty entirely.
Let me ask you a political question. I know right now the Tories have the majority. Well, they don't have the majority, but they have control of the government.
Ish. Yeah.
Yeah. If Labour or the Lib Dem, if they got together and did something, do you think NHS overall would improve? And do you think it would help for the trans community?
Yeah, I think so. I do. I do think so. But I mean, as general rule, I'm pretty apolitical. You know, I try not to get involved in the politics of stuff because I think politics is a good way to waste a lot of time over a subject that doesn't take that long to sort out. You know, and I think that there's a lot of self-serving people within politics, just in general. You know, I think it's a very self-serving career choice for certain people, especially those that have business interests before they go into politics.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure that...
I can think of one person in particular right now.
I can fully appreciate that, right? But, you know, it's no different to over here. You know, we've had, there's always stories in the news in the UK of politicians that, you know, have tried to abolish stamp duty, which is like a tax you pay on the selling of houses or the buying of houses.
Oh.
But they've got a, you know, they've got a side business where they buy and sell houses. You know, or,
well, that's convenient. You know,
do you know what I mean? You know, and it's so obvious. But the reality is that, you know, most people's lives are too difficult for them to worry about that kind of stuff because they, you know, the world's kind of messed up.
Let's leave the world of politics and go back to football. So you end up playing with the ladies team for a while. They say, you know, you're basically not welcome. How long until you play again?
A year.
Really?
A year. Yeah. And that was when I went down to London. I had a partner that I'd moved in with, and she had encouraged me to go and try and do it, because I'd been talking about missing football. And I think really, she, like my parents before her, had got pissed off with me doing keepy-ups in the kitchen. and it was like, just get out of the fucking house, you know? So I went onto Facebook and I did a search for trans football, you know, and I found an LGBT team called Soho FC. And yeah, I've played ever since.
Is there a moment when you enter the pitch where you go, yeah, this is where I need to be?
Yeah, I think I remember the first session I went. So I hadn't played football in a year. I hadn't exercised really for a year. And
I went and I tried to play football the way I'd always played football, and I was throwing up on the side of the pitch. I couldn't breathe. And it wasn't my best performance, I'll be honest. But the next time that I went, I kind of dialed it back a bit and just tried to enjoy playing. And I went for a drink with the team afterwards. And funny enough, there were a few players there that have said, you know, I didn't even realise you were trans. I just thought you were a lesbian playing with us. which was nice. You know, that was kind of really validating for me. I was kind of like, oh, okay. Like, I'm very self-conscious about how I look. And I think all trans people are. You know, that kind of gave me a lot of confidence to be like, oh, okay. You know, you're just judging me based on my football. What I look like hadn't even occurred to them. You know, they were all talking about, you know, you're really good for a girl.
know? Did you ever, do you tell them, or you're just like, oh, cool?
I mean, yeah, there's, you know, I'm pretty open with who I am, because I'm a firm believer that, although I don't necessarily want to have to tell people about my past, I think that you do run the risk of going back into just a weird, like, stealth closet. You know, you can go sort of like, as a term, you know, you're a stealth trans woman. No, nobody else knows that you're trans. You just live as a woman. And that's wonderful. I'd love that. But I think for me, I think I would feel that I'm not being true to myself, because there are realities that I wasn't born female, and I don't want to have to constantly worry about people finding out that I wasn't born female. And so I'm quite openly trans.
Why do you think they need to know?
Well, I don't tell you. It's not something I necessarily advertise to people if I meet them in the street. You know,
it's not like you have a car that says I'm trans.
No, exactly. It's not something I don't have a badge, for instance.
But why do you think it's important to tell people in certain relationships or?
I learned from my coming out experience that, you know, people, the last thing I want to do is dupe people. You know, the last thing I want is for people to feel like they've been duped, or for them to have a negative opinion of who I am because of who I am. And, you know, if somebody doesn't like me because I'm trans, then that's on them. That's not on me. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But the burden of hiding who I am because I fear people finding out that I'm trans, you know, I'm not willing to shoulder that burden.
Was it Soho or was it Bristol where you walked in Pride for the first time?
It was at Soho. It was at Soho.
What was that moment like for you? How did the build-up for it go? Like, how did you decide you wanted to do it?
It was just something, I think it's something the team do every year. There was a lot of talk of the day, and we had just, the team had won the London Unity League for the first time. I'd come on and scored in a cup final that we became runners-up in like a week or two beforehand. And it was the first time that I had felt part of a team as myself. And I guess I was just riding, I was really riding a wave, you know, and it was the best, one of the best days of my life, you know, being surrounded by friendly people, by people, you know, who I considered friends, and being surrounded by, you know, the streets lined 10 deep, cheering us on as we walked past. And it was a really, really good experience, and one that really, really contributed positively towards my self-confidence moving forward in my transition.
Oh, really?
Definitely. I think it was the first time that I'd ever witnessed like real mass acceptance in the streets for who I was.
Do you think that is one of your highest football moments then? The playing with that club?
Yeah, I would say that it was the first time that I felt like I had found my place within a football side, and that that I was able to play without any other worries.
And then so when you leave Soho, is that a tough decision for you?
Well, I got injured playing in a tournament in the summer. And more recently, obviously, I've moved down to Bristol, which is like the other side of the UK. But, you know, I found acceptance with Bristol Panthers. You know, I've been in training with them a few times. I'm still injured. I'm still out injured. I probably will be until after Christmas, unfortunately.
But what injury do you have?
I ruptured my cruciate ligament, which is really bad, in my left knee. So it's a real serious one. So I've got to, I mean, I'm up and I'm walking. I haven't got pain in it or anything like that. I'm able to run. Not, it's the changing direction that I struggle with.
Right. Yeah, any knee injury is going to be hard to come back from.
Yeah, and this isn't the first time I've had a knee injury in this particular knee. I've ruptured my collateral ligament in the same knee when I was, that was the injury that saw me sort of let go and from the Premier League side that I was at. And I've torn my cartilage in the same knee as well. So my knee, inside my left knee, is basically just cabbage at this stage.
So do you plan on getting surgery for it then, or?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm waiting for surgery. But again, you know, I injured my knee in August and I still haven't got a surgery date from the NHS.
Really? I've heard about the NHS is it really depends on where you are in the country and how the services.
100%. 100%. Because what is that? It's like divided into NHS trusts. So it's the way best way I can describe it is like if America had it, it'd be like an America-wide service, but the service you receive in, I don't know, Ohio would be better than the service you receive in New York because of the less population density.
Right. And then specialties and all that stuff too, depending on where you're at.
Yeah.
So you obviously, like I said, you reached out to me, and I know that I helped you get in touch with Without Sports, with Dawn.
Indeed.
And then you're obviously already working with some people in England. What made you decide to tell your story?
I just felt like it was the right time for me. I was struggling a little bit with this injury and not playing and not being able to sort of compete and play matches. I felt like it was the right time for me to kind of share this and to show people that There is always a place where you can play sport. There is always a place. And it might not be the place where you necessarily think you can. You know, I never thought that I'd be playing on a predominantly gay men's side in London. I did, and I found acceptance, and I loved every minute of it. And I didn't feel invalidated as a result, as a woman. If anything, I felt more validated as a woman because I was the only one there playing who... You know, and I was able to hold my own and was accepted, you know, even by the oppositions that I've played against, at the tournaments that I've played in. I've never once been misgendered. You know, even though everybody knows that I'm obviously there because I'm LGBT. You know, I've never had anything directed at me for being a girl, or it's great, you know, and it's a really, really positive thing to be part of here in England. And I guess it's something that is relatively new. You know, there's only probably 30 teams in the whole of the UK that are like freestanding teams. There's a lot of like LGBT teams that are like a supporters clubs from professional sides. And that's what Bristol Panthers are affiliated with Bristol City. Soho is a standalone side. They're not affiliated with any other club.
How did you get involved in Rainbow Rovers?
I was asked via through Soho. So I think Soho were asked to provide some players to go down that have a bit of a following. I've got a bit of a following in social media and stuff like that. So I was picked, and I think I ticked a lot of diversity. I think as often is the case, I ticked quite a few diversity boxes. and yeah, so I was asked to go down. I'd say unfortunately I got injured. I wasn't able to play. But there were a couple of other trans women that were picked on the side. People like Natalie Washington, I think, was picked, who I've spoken to a few times. Seems very, very lovely. They played a team of ex Premier League players.
Well, actually, okay, cool. I didn't know you played in that.
No, well, this is the thing. I was picked for it, and then I had my knee injury at that tournament the week beforehand, and then I was never able to play. But it is something that I'm trying to get more involved in. And we're trying to take Rainbow Rovers as a side, as a touring side. We're trying to take that to these the supporters clubs that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some plans for some really, really cool fixtures that we're going to set up, where we're going to try and get an ex-pro from each of the clubs. So we'll have an ex-pro from Liverpool, an ex-pro from Newcastle, blah, blah, blah. And they will captain a side of supporters that hopefully, if all goes to plan, we'll be able to bid in an auction for positions on that side. So it wouldn't matter what the supporters look like, what they dress like, what their gender identity is, you know, the ages, whatever. You can bid to play a match in your team's jersey and do that thing. It's all very grassroots at the moment. We haven't talked it through. It's just an idea, but it's something that we'd love to do, and try and raise some money for charities, for LGBT charities, especially ones closer to my heart, like suicide prevention and self-harm charities. So yeah, there's obviously that stuff with Rainbow Rose that we're looking to do. And I'm really keen to get a kit, so a Rainbow Rovers kit, that we can then sell and help donate some money to charity as well. So it will be a kit that is predominantly the gay, lesbian, LGBT, bisexual, trans flags incorporated into the designs all over it, and really push that kind of inclusive sport message. So they're all dreams and aspirations that I have, that, you know, hopefully will come to fruition in 2020. So stay tuned.
Nice. Yeah, and you could use your PR background to help get the word out.
That's the plan. But yeah, you know, I think it's really important to sort of spread that it's possible to just go and play football or go and do a sport and enjoy the sport for what the sport is. And not have to really worry about who you are, how you identify, what your sexuality is, because everybody there is diverse, and everybody there is, you know, is there for the same reasons, and that's just to enjoy the game.
You know, I can't imagine what you're doing for this generation of kids who might be struggling with the same thing. This generation is already the most accepting ever, obviously. I mean, they're going through the most, they have the most freedom for information, at least in most of our countries. I can't imagine what you're doing for kids who will hear this story, you know, with this podcast or with other outlets that you're going to end each episode of my podcast with this question. My question is this: if you could tell your 12 or 13 year old self, who already knows that your outside appearance doesn't match your inside, what's that one thing that you would tell yourself?
It's okay, very simply. It's okay. It's okay to be you, and you don't have to be scared that of any repercussions, because the reality is that the repercussions of not being yourself and not loving yourself are way, way worse. So be brave, be courageous, and be yourself.
Cool. Sammy, thank you so much for coming on this and talking. I've had a lot of fun.
No worries. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to my episode with Sammy Walker. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something out of it. If you like it, share it and spread the word. If you like this podcast, follow us at Apple Podcasts under Outsports, where you'll get my podcast and a few others. If you want to reach out to me, you can reach me at LPFPod on Twitter and Instagram. I'm also on Facebook. If you have any questions, you can email me at levelplainfieldpod@gmail.com. Next week, I'll have an all-new guest talking about all-new subject in sport. Until then, take care and see you next time.